Hallo bei den philosophischen Pauken, sagt Günter Friesinger. Heute mit einer Sendung, die sich wieder mit einem Vortrag auseinandersetzt, der bei der Robexotica 2006 beim Symposium Regulierungsträume, Kybernetik und Robotik als Universalwissenschaft gehalten wurde. Und zwar handelt es sich um einen Vortrag von Peter Assaro. Peter Assaro ist Philosoph, ist aber auch Künstler, hat unter anderem gearbeitet an der Galerie der Forschung, an der Akademie der Wissenschaften in Wien und hält einen Vortrag, in dem er sich die Frage stellt, was ist mit der Kybernetik passiert?
The 1940s saw the rise of the science of cybernetics, a science seemingly bent on universalism, aimed at refiguring all of the other sciences in its own image. Cybernetics followed in the heritage of 19th century Victorian dreams of the perfectly regulated political economy managed by perfectly regulated science. The dream of the previous century was for the science to provide the means to regulate all spheres of productive life. In the 20th century, science itself was to be brought under more careful and precise regulation, that offered by cybernetics. But what was cybernetics? What were the scope and extent of its dreams of regulation? Was it merely a good-willed interdisciplinary movement that saw real metaphorical resemblances between problems in different domains? Did it aspire to supplant and displace the other sciences with its own epistemology and metaphysics? Was it the heir apparent to the throne of science, or a mere pretender, seeking devious ways to undermine specialized knowledge well beyond its legitimate means? Was it a revolution in science, the science of the dawning age of information? Or was it merely a clever narrative about a fictional past that led to a rosy cybernetic future? In short, what was cybernetics? And what happened to it? Did it disappear because it failed in its revolutionary goals? Or did it disappear because it was so successful that it is now merely taken for granted? Indeed, did it disappear at all? These are some of the questions I hope to provide some insights in today. So what is or was cybernetics? A great deal of the problem of saying what happened to cybernetics depends on what we think cybernetics was. When I tell people that I study the history of cybernetics, they usually say, "Wow, that's interesting. So what's cybernetics?" When talking to people of various backgrounds who have already thought about the history of cybernetics, I find that there are at least three distinct things that they have in mind. And for your convenience today, I'll call these the broad view, the narrow view, and the internal view. And for those of you who have read the program statement for this year's Robo Exotica, you'll already be familiar with the main ideas of the broad view and have some hints at the narrow view. But why don't we start by looking into the etymology of cybernetics? The word cybernetics was coined by the MIT mathematician Norbert Wiener in the summer of 1947 to refer to the new science of command and control in animals and machines, which he helped to establish and develop. The word was derived from the Greek kubernetes, meaning steersman or ship pilot. Unknown to Wiener at the time, Plato had used the adjective kubernetikon in the Gorgias to refer to the science of piloting, and the French physicist André-Marie Ampère had derived the French word cybernétique directly from the Greek to refer to the science of government in his classification of the sciences, the Essai sur la philosophie des sciences. And so the root kuber leads us directly to governor, the regulator, guide, and pilot of steam engines and states. It thus lies at a powerful metaphorical intersection of political economy and technology, social and material order, and the regulation of animals and machines. The basic idea of cybernetics is that complex systems, such as living systems, societies, and brains, are self-regulated by the feedback of information. By systematically analyzing the feedback mechanisms which regulate complex systems, cybernetics hopes to discover the means of controlling these systems technologically and to develop the capability of synthesizing artificial systems with similar capabilities. And here we see James Watt's steam engine governor, which was an early mechanical feedback system. The narrow view. The narrow view of cybernetics is that the mechanism of negative feedback control is the metaphysically central to the order and organization of the universe. This was the theme of the original MACI conferences, which were actually called Symposia on Circular Causal and Feedback Mechanisms in Biological and Social Systems. The idea was to find these mechanisms in every science, and to thereby translate knowledge produced about them in one discipline to the problems of understanding them in another discipline. For those less familiar with the concept, a brief sketch may be in order. Negative feedback is the ability of a mechanism to receive information about the result of its own action, to calculate a correction based on the distance of that result from a pre-specified goal, and to act so as to reduce that distance. Negative feedback thus creates a circular causal loop whereby an action E causes an effect, which in turn causes a new action, which has been calculated to reduce the error in the next effect, and so on. The challenge of designing a useful machine for solving a given problem thus lies in determining how to perform the error-reducing calculation. Negative feedback can be realized by a very simple mechanism. A common example is the thermostat, which regulates the temperature of a room by turning the heat on when the temperature falls too low and switches it off again when the temperature rises. Another is James Watt's governor, which regulates a steam engine by opening a valve when it spins too fast and closing the valve again as it slows down. The basic concept of feedback was first developed seriously in 1932 by the engineer Nyquist in his regeneration theory, and reached maturity with the general theory of servo mechanisms published by McCall in 1945. Information was given a precise mathematical definition by the Bell Telephone Labs engineer Claude Shannon in his Mathematical Theory of Communication, published in 1948, though his work had been circulated in secret for nearly a decade before that. He defined information as a measure in the reduction of uncertainty caused by receiving a particular message from a whole set of possible messages. His formalisms drew upon Boolean logic and probability theory and derived a purely mathematical definition of information. But this was only a means to his ultimate goal, which took the form of the error-correcting channel for sending messages. His equations tell you how much noise can be allowed on a given channel, which tells you how many signals can be transmitted in a given period of time. And this is the fundamental mathematical theory which lets engineers pile thousands of telephone calls onto a single wire, and now millions of telephone calls into microwaves. Wiener began thinking about negative feedback when he was trying, along with Julian Bigelow and Arturo Rosenbluth, to design an anti-aircraft gun that would follow a moving target, called the AA predictor. When they wrote their landmark paper in 1943 on behavior, purpose, and teleology, they drew on both the servomechanical and the information theoretic concepts of feedback. The other landmark paper of 1943, McCulloch and Pitt's paper on the logical calculus of neural nets, used a radically different formalism drawn from Rudolf Carnap's positivist logic, one of the many Viennese connections to cybernetics, but was soon simplified to the Boolean logics of Shannon's formalisms. In it, they demonstrated mathematically that a cyclic neural network, one that fed back in upon itself, could instantiate a universal Turing machine, and thus implicitly argued that the brain was a universal computer. In the long run, most of the cyberneticians would follow the information formalism rather than the original servomechanical one. The reason is probably that the concept of information was itself far more universalizable than the concept of error correction alone. Being able to calculate the correction to the voltage of an electronic motor is not very intellectually inspiring all by itself. And with the development of the stored program digital computer over the next few years, the use of Boolean logic, its formalisms as information, and the potential of universal computation would all conspire to form a uniquely powerful concept for cybernetics to lay its claims to being a universal science, with computation as the universal technology. If we accept this narrow view of cybernetics as being the science of feedback control mechanisms, then cybernetics is alive and well. Of course, nobody calls it cybernetics anymore. They simply call it control theory or information theory. And there are still plenty of conferences on these topics every year. Mostly this work consists in hardcore engineering disciplines, servomechanical control systems at the border of electrical and mechanical engineering, their application in robotic systems and manufacturing processes, the design of control systems for planes and rockets, and increasingly in automobiles with such things as electronic fuel injection systems, anti-lock brakes, and traction control systems, and countless other industrial and consumer applications. As the basis of information theory and signal processing, it is central to the hardware that makes cell phones, the Ethernet, wireless networks, and these sorts of things actually work. In each case, the basic theories which enable these technologies is the self-regulated mechanism, negative feedback, or error-correcting signal processors. Again, in each case, there is a rich history of technical advancement, much of it conducted without much concern for cybernetics per se, its universal ambitions, or world vision. It would be impossible to say what percentage of these technologies depend on cybernetics. Indeed, one could probably make a convincing case that cybernetics itself merely appropriated servomechanical control theory and information theory as its first disciplinary conquest, from which it began telling stories of its historical inevitability and impending conquest of the other sciences, which it then pursued in earnest. If the narrow view is thus drawn from a close reading of the underlying mathematical theories and with the technological products of those theories, then it appears to be not so universalizing. While it has enabled many of the significant technologies of the information age, computers, guided missiles, mobile phones, robots, the internet, it has not rewritten our basic understanding of science and society. In the end, it is just one important and useful part of engineering among many. The broad view starts from taking the rhetoric of cybernetics seriously. This is the view promoted by the introductory statement of this year's Robo Exotica, Dreams of Regulation. In its self-centered retellings of the history of science and human civilization as leading ultimately and inevitably to the science of cybernetics, it created its own mythology. The age of matter was passing away, and the age of form was ascending. The age of industry, symbolized by the steam engine, was giving way to the age of information, symbolized by the computer. And where physics had promised to give humanity domination over matter and energy, cybernetics now promised to give humanity domination over information and organization. This was how cybernetics saw itself as replacing physics as the science upon which all others would be based. Cybernetics was thereby nothing if not radical and revolutionary. It sought to overthrow the entire scientific order as handed down from Newton, and with it the social and political order. It should be noted that most of the people involved in the design and the construction of the first stored program digital computers, notably Turing, von Neumann, and Julian Bigelow, this is Turing's first computer, were all involved in the cybernetics groups before they built the first computers. This is the Ratio Club, which is a British cybernetics group that met in the late 1940s. You can see Turing is down in the corner. The guy I work on, Ashby, is in the middle. They also explicitly drew on cybernetic concepts of feedback and information, and especially McCulloch and Pitt's neural networks paper and the actual design in their actual designs for the first computers. Von Neumann's Institute for Advanced Study Machine, here and seen here, and Turing's ACE machine, which stands for Automatic Computing Engine. Moreover, their explicit aim in designing these machines was to automate the calculation of scientific models. Draw the whole of science into the practice of representing knowledge as mathematical models. In short, the digital computer is the quintessential cybernetic device. The strategy for the cybernetic revolution was ambitious and multifaceted, but it was also comprehensive and organic. Indeed, much of the compelling nature of its rhetoric derived from the consistency and elegance of its theology. All the parts fit together and reinforced one another. At the center of its rhetorical strength was the double move of establishing itself as providing a universal language for science and promoting this language through interdisciplinary projects and conferences and the use of the computer and computational models. By the early 1940s, Nicholas Ursheshevsky was leading a weekly discussion group at the University of Chicago, which sought to turn biological knowledge into mathematical models. It was here that the young Viennese physicist Heinz von Forster was first introduced to Warren McCulloch, and where a few years earlier, Walter Pitts had also been introduced to McCulloch. By the late 1940s, the Macy conferences established the paradigm of the new interdisciplinary cybernetics. It brought together leading researchers in engineering, mathematics, physics, chemistry, biology, psychology, psychiatry, medicine, anthropology, economics, sociology, and philosophy. The goal was to co-opt the other sciences by getting them to speak the same language, the language of cybernetics. The strategy was to bring them together to talk about their own problems, to find the shared metaphors, to apply new metaphors and encourage the use of new cybernetic language. Less than 2 years later, in England, a group calling itself the Ratio Club began meeting for monthly cybernetic discussions. They had emerged from a conference on mathematical biology and set themselves the purpose of determining to what extent the human mind could be understood and simulated mathematically. All of these early cybernetic groups were alike in that they brought together different disciplines to discuss their problems with shared metaphors and the language of information and feedback. Again, the rhetoric of this strategy is remarkably powerful. Many scientists, not only those who attended the cybernetic meetings, were impressed by the new language and the promise of finding insights into their problems from other disciplines. And there was a genuine energy unleashed in these interdisciplinary collaborations which ensued. Mathematicians working with medical doctors, electrical engineers working with psychiatrists, and so forth. Cybernetics cannot, however, claim to be the original author of interdisciplinary science. Rather, that credit goes to World War II. The great powers fighting that war recognized early on that science could provide the advantages necessary to win. They brought together scientists from many disciplines to solve the practical problems of warfighting. Operations research was one such product of this effort, in which mathematics was brought to bear on nearly every aspect of war strategy and tactics, from the search patterns of planes looking for U-boats, to the ideal size of a supply convoy, and ultimately to the prototype of big science itself, the Manhattan Project, and its world-shattering atomic bomb. Indeed, it was the development of an intelligent anti-aircraft gun that had brought the Wiener team together, and the British and American teams that built the first digital computers, as well as Shannon and Weaver, who brought us information theory. Thus, at its birth, cybernetics, interdisciplinarity, and World War II are all bound up in a tight circular causal loop that would be difficult to untangle. The mythological power that thereby surrounded cybernetics was also tied up in the historical moment it found itself in, and was extrapolated directly from Christian mythology of creation and destruction. The world had grown wary of war and longed to be far more rational. It had seen a new and godlike powers put in human hands. The atomic bomb presented both the image and the reality of a new kind of apocalypse. DNA offered a new mythology of origins. And robotics and automata promised to give humans the ability to create life and become themselves gods. And it was cybernetics which wrote the narrative that connected these together, presented a scientific history of an evolving universe that would lead inevitably to the intelligent human civilization and place in its hands the means to its own destruction and the creation of its successors. Cybernetics offered not only a way to understand this history, but to manage and control it. It offered game theory as the means of managing the political crisis of nuclear arms. It offered technological control as the means of providing a better life, and it offered information as the metaphysical and economic basis of this brave new world. Cybernetics is, in this view, simply equated with a technological utopia enabled by and articulated through information, communication, and computation. If we accept this broad view, we are already living in the age of cybernetics, though maybe we just call it the age of information. It does not matter that nobody practices anything called cybernetics, because everybody is always already cybernetic, everywhere and all the time. While it is not without some appeal, perhaps this is too broad a view. What else might cybernetics be? It is too narrow to say that it is just feedback mechanisms, and it is too broad to say that it is a techno-utopianism. Rather, the truth must lie somewhere in between. Practitioners of cybernetics seem to be aware that of the untenability of the grand universalizing project. On the one hand, they all believed that the world was quintessentially cybernetic, and while they wished to reform the sciences with the universal language of systems and mathematical models, they realized that this language was easily appropriated, misused, and abused. Everywhere, scientists were popping up and laying claim to these terms, and doing some rather uninteresting things with them. This is one of the interesting things. In particular, there was the new field of artificial intelligence. While its pioneers had been trained by the cyberneticians, and its aims of achieving human intelligence in machines were deeply cybernetic, by the 1960s, political rifts had formed around it. McCulloch saw AI as being little more than the construction of toys and the solving of logical puzzles. He did not see that it could offer any insights into the human mind because it failed at a fundamental level to address the structure and operation of the brain. From the other side, Marvin Minsky and Seymour Papert had published a logical critique of neural networks in their book Perceptrons. This had the effect of killing funding for neural network research for a decade and forced AI researchers to distance themselves from cyberneticians. The cyberneticians regrouped around new research themes, such as bionics and self-organizing systems, but by the end of the 1960s, they found it hard to get funding. The choice to regroup around bionics and self-organizing systems was one aspect of a movement internal to cybernetics, and so I will call this the internal view. With the rise of a new generation of cybernetics researchers in the mid-1950s, a decade after cybernetics had first come together, came an even more radical vision of what cybernetics was. It would come to call itself second-order cybernetics. And its mythology was based upon distancing itself from first-order cybernetics of Wiener and McCulloch. This time the basic thrust was to be epistemic rather than metaphysical. Cybernetics would again be defined by a feedback, but now it was between a system and its observer, rather than merely being within the system being observed. What made this radical was that the observer was part of the system being observed. And this is also what made it epistemic rather than metaphysical. Observation was the central concern. The movement to second-order cybernetics was led by Heinz von Forster. Though he had served as the editor of the original Macy conferences, he was still a generation younger than all of the other participants. Indeed, it was not until 1958 that he was allowed to run his own lab dedicated to cybernetics research, the Biological Computer Lab at the University of Illinois. We can see in this history of this lab the rise and fall of second-order cybernetics, and perhaps also a metaphor for cybernetics itself. This is one of the machines they built. This was an electronic ear from the early 60s. This is one of their electronic brains from 1959 called the Adaptive Reorganizing Automata. And those are both analog computers. As a physicist, von Forster was captivated by the advances in atomic physics, and in particular the uncertainty principle. What intrigued him about this was that the observer was inherently part of the system being observed. It was not possible to measure the position and spin of an electron without disturbing the system in such a way that one of these bits of information was lost. In subsequent investigations into the nature of time and observation, von Forster convinced himself that this relation held for all systems and therefore all scientific knowledge. This insight held several implications, most notably ethical and aesthetic ones, about how one chooses a system and how to treat a system under observation and to always explicitly consider the role of the observer. That the BCL was the birthplace of second-order cybernetics is also borne out by the fact that the other major figures in the area were all early visitors and frequent guests. And the first visitor was the young Gordon Pask, who came to the BCL to grow ears and neurons in electrolyzed chemical solutions. He was soon followed by Stafford Beer, who would later go on to reorganize the Chilean economy around a cybernetic vision with a centralized computer, all under the direction of Allende, at least until a CIA-supported coup put an end to it all. Two other young Chilean cyberneticians were also brought to the BCL to escape the reprisals of Pinochet, Umberto Maturana and Francisco Varela. Heinz von Forster himself worked to help them escape the country and arranged for visiting positions for them at the BCL. While they were there, they completed and published their notorious tract on autopoiesis. The power of a self-organizing system to bring itself into existence. It stood at once as a theory of how life could come into being and how a mind could become conscious. In each case, the essential thing was reflexivity, that the observer observed itself and observed itself observing itself, and so forth. This idea became central to, among other things, the Gaia theory, in which the Earth is an autopoietic system, breathing life into itself, quite literally. With all its good intentions to insert critical and ethical reflexivity into the most fundamental aspects of science, namely empirical observation, it was soon caught up in the radical politics of the 1960s. This made for some exciting scientific, artistic, and political work at the BCL in the early 1970s, much of it summarized in the 1974 publication, The Cybernetics of Cybernetics. If anything marks the end of the cybernetic movement, it is The Cybernetics of Cybernetics. With DARPA and ONR redirecting their funds to the MIT AI lab, the BCL had struggled to find funding for several years. In his final desperate act, von Forster had developed a proposal in 1972 to the Department of Education, which aimed to build a vast electronic online encyclopedia built on top of the Plato network system that had been recently developed by the Coordinated Science Lab at Illinois. While von Forster's fans see this proposal as an early vision of the Internet, it was really something more like a Wikipedia, in which the user could type in any question and get access to the best available knowledge on the subject. Regardless of whether it was truly prescient of the World Wide Web, the proposal was nothing less than visionary and ambitious. It is therefore none too surprising that it failed, even to receive funding for a pilot program. Von Forster announced his retirement and closed the BCL soon after. As its title suggests, The Cybernetics of Cybernetics is a hyper-reflexive work. It recapitulates the great texts of cybernetics, its lectures and pedagogy, and even the student projects of the BCL. But it is more archive than narrative history or textbook, almost a time capsule. A parabook appears in the middle with indices and acknowledgments, and it even includes a detachable metabook with conceptual maps of the various contributors and key terms. Despite its radical structure and intent, the whole book resonates like the death knell for cybernetics, because its history is in some sense completed. There's no more cybernetics to be done, at least not any that requires the laborious recapitulation necessary to connect to this history. It is both an archaeological memory trace and the end of cybernetic history. The cybernetic mythology did live on, in the sense that discourse in many diverse fields are still being broken down into systems, information, feedback, and networks, all the more so since the advent of the Internet and cyberspace. But since 1974, nothing of great significance has been added to the cybernetic corpus. And so I submit that what happened to cybernetics is this: it ate its own tail. Just as second-order cybernetics brought itself into existence autopoetically, it destroyed itself by failing to believe in itself any longer. But it stands ready to rise again from the ashes and be reborn, anywhere, anytime, through autopoetic love or through a cocktail-making robot who begins to question its own existence and motives.
Can you elucidate for me the connection between cybernetics and the rise of so-called artificial intelligence research?
Yes. How long do you want the answer to be?
They say an elevator pitch.
Oh, right. Okay. How many floors?
16.
16 floors. Okay. Not the express, I hope. So what you have in the earliest AI, I guess, you can sort of look at people like Marvin Minsky, Alan Newell, Herbert Simon. They were very, very close to the cyberneticians. They were working in their labs as graduate students. Herbert Simon and Alan Newell were working on von Neumann's machine at RAND Corporation when they wrote their first AI program. Minsky was a student of McCulloch briefly, and his first device was a neural network actually called Pandemonium that he built and that McCulloch thought was great. So they have this, but they were sort of these graduate students beneath these big, great scientists that were the founders of the so-called first-order cybernetics. And they saw, I think, more promise in exploiting the possibilities of digital computation itself rather than really getting at the brain. And if you look at the, let me go back here into this one of these earlier pictures, this one here. So these are let's call them the four founders of cybernetics. Three of them are originally psychiatrists or physiologists. So you have on the, I guess it's your left as well. Ashby and McCulloch are both psychiatrists who start working with electronics. Walter is a, just like cybernetics, waiting to wake up someday. So Walter's a physiologist, and Wiener's a mathematician, right? So you have this very physiological sway that they're really interested in biology and they're really interested in brains and at the cybernetics level. But these AI people are much more interested in logic, mathematics, using the digital computer. And if you look at these machines at the BCL, even into the 60s and into the late 60s, they're primarily analog machines, and they're really trying to imitate brains and biology in a much more explicit way to understand how the brain works rather than what becomes AI and cognitive science, which is taking this computational metaphor very seriously in a logical formalism. And that's the sort of the basic distinction conceptually. Now, historically, there's this fissure between them in the 60s over perceptrons. Minsky and Papert criticized the ability of neural networks to do what's basically an exclusive OR in logic, that you can't learn this with a single layer neural network, right? And they demonstrate this in a 200-page book over and over and over again, every different way. And it was, everybody already knew that. It wasn't any big news, but it created a scandal that caught the ear of all the people at the Department of Defense and DARPA and Office of Naval Research. And so they're like, oh, well, neural networks aren't any good. We can't keep investing in them. So they cut off all the funding, and they gave it all to the MIT AI lab that Minsky set up, and he got millions and millions of dollars through the 70s. Eventually, neural networks come back, and by the 90s, they sort of hash out their differences, and now they're all one big happy family again, I guess you'd say. But there's still large differences between what would be called computational neuroscience and what's called AI today, in terms of whether you're trying to model the brain with a computational model or whether you're just trying to build a useful device that uses some sort of intelligence. So that would be the relation. And then you have second-order cybernetics as the kind of counter-response to AI, coming up with a lot of linguistic second-order discussions.
You know, I'm trying to context all this, and because I'm paranoid into, you know, my developing theory of the control society and how we're controlled. And there is, you know, you've heard of Jose Delgado, who conducted experiments in attaching electrodes on various subjects, and he was able to, you know, with the flick of a switch on a little controller to be, stop a charging bull in its tracks. I mean, do you have any information about this line of research, which has to do with hardware control of the human, of a brain, or?
Yeah, so there's been quite a bit of work on it. The more successful stuff is the reverse. So using the brain to control hardware has been more successful. A company I worked at for a little while developed a chip that would generate walking motions, and it's a coupled oscillator system. And they were able to sever the spinal cord of a lamprey and insert the chip and restore swimming capacities in the fish. They have now, for amputees, you can basically rewire using nerves in the chest to control an arm actuator, and you can learn to manipulate these. And even for people who are almost completely paralyzed, they can use brain waves and facial nerves, if they have any nerve that functions, use that to control a mouse and a computer and all of this kind of stuff. So the sort of the output side of it is, it's pretty straightforward, because we kind of know where nerves go, and we can, as long as your mind is able to trigger a motor nerve, you can reroute that motor nerve to any kind of system you want. And you can learn to control it, because our brains learn and adapt. Going the other way is trickier. They've done some things with trying to restore sensation. Wiener worked on some things that were trying to help the blind see by actually putting like 300 little pins on their back that would be actuated by a visual pattern so they could try to see using the nerves on their back, which didn't work very well. but the brain is very adaptive, so I would say potentially you could use lots of different sensory systems. In terms of getting inside the brain and how the brain actually represents the world or concepts or memories, it's completely black box at this point. We have no idea, and we have no ability to manipulate. You can, you know, shock people's brains and stimulate dreams and hallucinations and experiences, and you could map it out for each individual, but it's going to be different for every individual. And it's whether it's a dream, an actual memory or just a hallucination, is nobody can tell.
So there hasn't been more complicated extensions of Pavlovian type experiments.
Well, there have. I mean, they have, you know, mice that you can drive by remote control, and I mean, there's a lot of strange things they do that are deeply Pavlovian. But nothing we have to worry about in terms of actually controlling your brain yet.
But aren't we really controlled by images and little sound bites, really?
Yeah, I would say in a much more powerful way. And that's how social control works, for the most part, propaganda and controlling ideas and information.
That brings me to my question about, there's a really curious film by Lutz Dombeck, who is an East German filmmaker from Leipzig, who did a film called Das Netz, or The Net, and it links topics like LSD and Ted Kaczynski and computers and the internet in a very unusual way. And he's actually, in this film, takes a look at the goes back to looking at the Macy Conference as something that was basically trying to create a kind of social control mechanism or something. And I wonder if you could talk about that in terms of the way you see the internet developing. Is it something that we should be really paranoid about in terms of how the cybernetics origins and the military agenda with the internet have kind of created a network, does quite a good job of creating a kind of a potential social control mechanism more than any, like, more than one yeah. person can really grasp.
No, I have seen this film, and it features an interview with Heinz von Forster at the end, which was not his best interview, perhaps. But I think there's a you can make these paranoid visions, but actually, I would say the internet is probably a much at least has the potential to subvert a lot of propaganda, and I think that's what we're seeing. And you know, the independent media, and even things like YouTube, just adding interactivity, and that's a deeply cybernetic concept. As long as we're just taking orders and we never give back any information, then we're not even cybernetic organisms. We're just material. And the ability to transmit feedback back to the system is the only potential for any kind of political influence. And to the extent that the internet allows two-way communication, it has political possibilities. And I think what you see are institutions and governments that don't want that, doing everything they can to try to put the genie back in the bottle. And there's a lot of talk about regulating the internet and letting basically corporations own all the bandwidth and sell it off so that it becomes a purely economic system. Your ability to speak on the internet will be economically determined. Right now, it's popularity determined. If you have enough hits and you have the servers to support it, you can have the biggest audience that you can obtain. But there's attempts to try to regulate that.
I have both positive and negative perspective on it, but there is sort of, I wonder if you have looked into the sort of panopticon theory, that there's a panopticon effect, that the things that get the most hits are the kinds of things that people feel safe communicating, but if it's not, if it's something really subversive, you really don't put it on the internet.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm certainly I think people are fearful, right? So, I mean, you don't want to put things that are potentially illegal or harmful to you directly that can be related back to you. But the internet also provides the ability to hide your identity. I mean, you know, Al-Qaeda is using the internet to organize itself. Well, one of the early studies done on political action to the internet was actually one of the big cybernetic companies, the RAND Corporation, studied the Zapatistas and revolution in Mexico, and they were highly successful in using the internet to get their message out and to make a global political issue out of it, which actually halted the advance of the Mexican army and suppressing them quite successfully. Of course, then you have organizations like the RAND analyzing how that's possible and then informing governments and institutions how to prevent that from happening. And that's a lot of what you saw in, say, the Republican National Convention in New York, where they used some pretty sophisticated technologies to jam cell phones and this sort of thing, because they were aware that a lot of they would do these speed movements, so that they had all these text networks set up using SMS and texting messages on cell phones, because they couldn't just put up a web page that said, oh, let's all meet at this plaza and have a demonstration, because the police would know about it instantly, and they had informants working in all these groups. So they had a very closed system where they would just have one or two people know where they were going to meet, and they would send it to a computer network that would relay text messages to all of their members. And so they could, in less than 10 minutes, organize more than 1,000 people into a square and then dissipate very quickly so they couldn't get caught. But so they started using all of these jamming technologies to shut down cell phones all over Manhattan for the conventions. So, I mean, but you have a back and forth. Like, you know, it's whoever's more creative is going to, you know, be supreme with technology. And that's why we need more technology artists.
So, Peter, thank you for your really interesting story of cybernetics. But I was a bit astonished. It was kind of a Hegelian tale of cybernetics, like cybernetics eating its own tail in the 70s. Because on the other side, you have, as you mentioned, again, research on neural nets. You had artificial life, and now, or not now, but in the 80s, it was no more Marvin Minsky, but Rodney Brooks, who kind of developed biologically inspired robotics, and they often draw on the work, for example, of Gray Walter. So what about that branch? And so is there any connection between contemporary robotics or certain kinds of contemporary robotics and cybernetics?
Well, yes, yes and no. So obviously, yes, because anything robotic is using servo mechanisms, and so even on the narrow view, it can be considered a cybernetic, and of course on the broad view, it's cybernetic. And in the more important sense, they do read the texts, and they see that what they do as being part of that tradition. But what I would say, and then on the negative side as well, they're a domesticated form of cybernetics that there's still a handful of cybernetics departments floating around that call themselves that. But for the most part, they have to say that they're electrical engineers or computer scientists or roboticists, or right. They don't, nobody has a business card that says, I'm a cybernetician. At least I haven't seen one yet, even at cybernetics conferences. And there still are cybernetics conferences, which are sort of strange, actually. The American Society for Cybernetics is actually having a meeting in February. But they're dominated by second-order cybernetics and a very kind of literary aesthetic approach to these ideas of autopoiesis. And there's no science and there's no machines that really come out of those. That's more performance art and poetry. But they can still be interesting, and they consider themselves cybernetics, but it's not a vital science. It's not getting any research funding. It's not producing new technologies and new theories. It's just repeating the old theories in new ways. And you have Rodney Brooks in these, definitely, who are pushing science forward. and they're starting from a background of cybernetics, but whether what they do is cybernetic is arguable.